Welcome to the Riches Podcast Series. This is our summer 2013 content we are delivering to you before we launch our new series, A History of Central Florida, in August of 2013. This is a two-part interview with Dr. Jim Clark from the University of Central Florida. In this second part, we talk with Dr. Clark about his book, Presidents in Florida, and his forthcoming book, Pineapple, Anthology of Florida Writers, Volume 1. All right, I'm here with Dr. Jim Clark, and we're going to talk about his book, Presidents in Florida. And so what drew you to this project?
As the 2012 election year approached, I began thinking more and more about the presidency. My studies for my graduate degree were in Florida politics, and it's always fascinated me. And what I found was that that Florida had an interesting history with presidents, that although we've never had a presidential candidate from Florida or a vice presidential candidate, we've played a role in deciding elections, and we've been a vacation spot for presidents.
And so was there an initial story, an initial incident that drew you to a topic like this, or was it just everything you've been hearing in 2012 with presidential elections?
I was struck by, as I thought about it, how many presidents had been involved with Florida, that how many presidents had confronted problems in Florida or found election success in Florida or defeat, and how the Florida had played a role in the presidency without electing a president of its own.
Is there a point, I guess, that Florida gets onto the presidential radar in any way?
I think so. After World War II, a couple of things happen, which is kind of funny, because probably Truman was the president who had come to Florida the most. He spent 7 months of his term at what was known as the Little White House in Key West. Nixon, of course, had the Key Biscayne White House that he came down to whenever he could get away from Washington, owned eventually a compound of three homes on Key Biscayne. But what I found was that presidents no longer come and spend a week or even a weekend or in some cases a month, as Truman would do. They only come down to make an appearance, to raise money, and stay a few hours, and they're gone. Meanwhile, although the state has become less important in terms of presidents visiting and vacationing here, as our electoral votes have grown, our importance politically has increased. People don't realize that on the eve of World War II, Florida was the smallest state in the South. And today, it's the fourth largest state in the Union, and closing in on number three, I think, and has 29 electoral votes. So in a period of three generations, we've gone from three electoral votes to 29.
And so this, of course, do you think is what interests candidates?
Sure. They want the electoral votes. As was pointed out in 2012, Mitt Romney could not win the presidency without taking Florida. And sure enough, he lost Florida, and it was among the reasons he lost the presidency. But for the Republicans, Florida is a must-win state. Here's an amazing fact. No Republican has been elected president without carrying Florida since Calvin Coolidge in 1924. So it's a vital state.
Mm-hmm. And so before it had this electoral influence, what would have been the draw to Florida?
The weather. It starts really in the 1800s. Chester Arthur is the first president to come to Florida. He goes fishing at what now is Walt Disney World, a place called Reedy Creek, and says the fishing is the best in the world. His associates don't want to fish. They go and shoot alligators on Lake Toho, And I think what really surprised me about Arthur, his predecessor, James A. Garfield, had been assassinated. And yet, there's Chester A. Arthur fishing by himself in the wilds of Florida. There's Chester A. Arthur walking around St. Augustine by himself, going to church by himself, with no protection, nothing at all. Republicans came down in the late 1800s, early 1900s, looking for nice weather, but also looking for votes. Although the South was solidly Democratic, the few Republicans that there were in the state, including many African Americans, did participate in the Republican convention. So candidates like Ulysses S. Grant came down here trying to get Florida support for their bid for the Republican nomination. Arthur comes down, McKinley comes down for that. Grant comes down when he's trying for a third term in 1880. And, of course, he was unsuccessful in getting the nomination, although Florida remained loyal to him through all the ballots until Garfield was nominated. So presidents came down to play and to look for votes.
There was always that famous photo of Grant on the steamship going down the St. John's.
Right. And, of course, steamships was the primary method of travel for many people. And he came down and dedicated one of the steamship lines, turned some dirt, shovel full of dirt for the dedication. But then went to the convention in Chicago and lost the nomination.
So that was that trip specifically for getting votes out, or was it just a...
Grant had done a strange thing. His administration had been tarred by scandals, as everyone knows, and he had gone on an around-the-world trip, which brought him great publicity, great attention. He went all over the world, met with crowned heads. Everybody was happy to meet with him. But when he came back to San Francisco, he kind of came back too early. And the result was that the good publicity died down and people began to talk about the scandals. So to get the scandals off the front page, they had him come to Florida and spend some time before the convention. And then everyone, Harper's Weekly and all the publications, wrote about him in Florida. So they were trying to take off the stigma of the scandal.
And I know Warren G. Harding, too, had a kind of a, I don't know if it was a fondness for Florida, but he visited Florida.
He loved Florida. He came here several times. This is one of those stories about how the world has changed. Can you imagine what would happen today when President Harding was president-elect? This is a couple months before he was sworn in, but had been elected. He came down to Florida and went on a friend's boat around present-day Titusville on the Indian River. And the boat got stuck on a sandbar. And I just visualize if that happened today, you'd have helicopters and rescue craft, and within minutes it would be off the sandbar. But the ship stayed there for a couple of days. Harding eventually rowed ashore in a dinghy, hired a taxi cab to drive him around, and then came back to the dock, bought some mullet from a fisherman on the dock, rowed back to their ship. They cooked mullet for dinner. The next day, the tide came in, raised the boat, and they sailed off. But here's the president-elect of the United States stranded on a sandbar for more than a day, and nobody says anything about it. Could you imagine if that happened today?
Yeah.
He also went to South Florida and got caught up in the South Florida publicity machine. And in one of the great photos of all time, Warren G. Harding is playing golf, and his caddy is a baby elephant with the clubs strung across its back. And so every paper, of course, in the country put that on their front page.
Yeah. So did, I mean, during that time, that early, late 19th century, early 20th century, did a a presidential visit to a town or city create a lot of a lot of interest? A lot of
no, it out? You know, it's strange. It didn't. There would be crowds of people who turned out, but it's not like today where they close off the interstate and do all this kind of stuff. It was very low key. Calvin Coolidge came to Orlando one time. He was staying at the Lakeside Inn in Mount Dora. And again, talk about a different era. His cousin from Orlando drove up, picked Coolidge and his wife Grace up. The three of them, no protection, nothing, drove back to Orlando. He spent the night in his cousin's house in downtown Orlando. And the next day, the cousin took him back up to Mount Dora and the Lakeside Inn. Very kind of simple kinds of visits.
And I guess if we're talking about, I guess, presidential history, probably one of the most, maybe colorful or dangerous events was the attempted assassination of Roosevelt.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt loved Florida. He had come here as a young man. And in the 1920s, after he was paralyzed, he came here frequently. He had a yacht off Fort Lauderdale. And he, as many people do who have disabilities, was of the mind that he was going to lick it. And he told his doctors he would walk again. And he thought that swimming in the ocean would restore strength to his legs. So he came down here frequently to swim in the Atlantic Ocean. That didn't work. He came down here a few weeks before his inauguration in 1933, went out on the yacht of John Jacob Astor, spent a week at sea, came back and agreed to make a speech in Bayfront Park in Miami. Rather than get the wheelchair out, go through all that, they decided he would just sit on the back of the car, on the convertible top, which was down, and make a few remarks to the crowd. As he finished his speech, a crazy man jumped out of the crowd, began firing shots, miraculously missed Roosevelt. It's almost impossible to understand how he could have missed Roosevelt, but hit the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak, who was next to Roosevelt. Cermak died a day or so later, but Roosevelt miraculously was not injured.
And now I believe the location's a park, right?
It was a park then, and now it's right near where the arena is, where the new arena is in Miami.
And there's a memorial there.
There is a thing there, yeah. So where Bayfront Park is, but it's very different from when Roosevelt was there.
So is that the only notorious presidential story we have in Florida?
I think so. I think some future presidents have come here to get fame. Zachary Taylor came to fight Indians, and I think you'd agree that he didn't really beat the Indians, but he didn't lose as badly as everybody else who fought the Indians did. The Seminoles, as you know, were able to go into the Everglades and just hide out. But he did the best of any of the generals. And the result was he came to fame and was promoted and and put in charge in the Mexican-American War, and then went to the White House. Teddy Roosevelt leaves Tampa for Cuba, and fame at the San Juan Hill battle, which propels him into the White House a few years later. So two people came down here and became famous. We've also decided two elections. The election of 1876, Florida played the key role in electing a Republican. And in 2000, of course, the Bush-Gore race, played the key role in electing a Republican.
So did any presidential candidate or anyone connected to a president have any infamy in Florida? There's all this fame that could be created, is there?
I can't think of anyone who made their name here. A former presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, settled in South Florida and worked for a real estate company promoting what's now Coral Gables. And his daughter, was the first woman elected to Congress from Florida, Ruth Bryant Owen, in the 1920s.
Mm. So it seems that Florida touches just a large swath of
It does. From George Washington to Barack Obama, presidents have been involved with Florida.
All right, so now I understand you're working currently on a project on, if I've got this correct, literature.
I've been fascinated by the fact that Florida has produced so many writers, and so many writers have come here either to get warm or to be inspired. But, for example, Robert Frost, when you close your eyes and think of Robert Frost, I bet you envision snow and gently rolling countryside. Few people realize that he had a house in Coral Gables and lived for a time in Key West. Almost bought a house in Gainesville and settled there. But he came to Florida and wrote a lot. And of course, everybody knows about Ernest Hemingway and Key West. But they aren't as familiar with John Dos Passos in Key West. We've identified about 70 authors, ranging from mystery writers to early Spanish explorers, and Carl Hiaasen and Dave Barry and Edna Buchanan. And the idea is to do a 3-volume anthology of their writings with profiles of each one. And the first volume will be out this fall.
So by any chance, I'm not trying to blindside you here, but are you looking at all at Stephen Vincent Benet, who famously wrote about Florida but never visited Florida?
Yeah, it's funny. We found Benet. The other one is Hart Crane, the poet, who wrote a whole sheaf of poems called Key West and never made it to Key West. John Greenleaf Whittier wrote a poem called The Branded Hand about a escaped slave case, which was had national attention, and he never visited Florida. So there have been a number of people who have written about Florida and never set foot in Florida.
So do you think that you're going to be able to include those?
Yes, I think they're in the lineup now. We haven't the first volume is done. The second volume is almost done. And I'm just getting started on the third volume.
All right. Well, thank you again. I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you for joining me for The Riches Podcast. If you enjoyed this interview, look for Jim Clark's books with Pineapple Press.